sofa next to you, please raise your hand so people can get seated. There's seating up top too. Please be seated. We're about to start the meeting. Welcome to the 8th anniversary celebration of the sponsorship group. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All are welcome, but we limit participation to alcoholics. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. We have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses. In accordance with our 7th tradition, we are going to pass the basket. If you're not an alcoholic, please do not contribute. It is our group's desire to leave every meeting place in better condition than it was when we arrived. We ask that you clean up after yourself and those who are incapable of doing so for themselves. Please do not bring beverages or any food into the sanctuary. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I've asked Sabrina to read the original manuscript of How It Works.
Continue to take personal inventory and learn from You may exclaim, what an ordinance. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints.
What's the point? What is the point?
The point is that we are willing to grow on spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of alcoholics, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. And C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced of these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
Please turn off all phones at this time so we do not disrupt the speakers. And I've asked Jeff to read the short form of the 12 traditions.
Hi, everybody. I'm getting out of the wall. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups for AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose. Carry to members from the alcohol and store stoppers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend an AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside our contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service center may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Ten, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on tragedy rather than corruption. We always maintain our personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality.
I'd like to introduce Tom Flynn, who's going to speak for 15 minutes on sponsorship and then introduce Clancy.
Living in amazement. I'm just totally amazed. Like, I generally feel like an 8-year-old boy in a big candy store with a $20 bill. That's how I generally, with a sweet tooth. You know? But I see you people, you know, all different states of both location and mind. This is fantastic. It's a high. Like, God, like pat you on the back or something, you know? Yeah, boy. Yeah. Go up there and tell the truth. And if you can't tell the truth, be brief. So, you can get one or the other, so okay. I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been an adventure for me. Now, I got to AA with the wonderful gift of desperation. When I hit AA, the first time I got here, I stayed. I didn't know you could leave. I was here 4 months. I thought I had a right to New York and get a resignation or something. I didn't make it without AA. I didn't have a sponsor first. And when I came to you, my life in such an order, I was willing to turn my will and my life over to Ronald McDonald. That's the kind of shape I was in. I didn't come to talk about philosophy, theology, or any other ology, you know. And I was looking around for a guy, for a sponsor, trying to find somebody I could relate to, you know. But I couldn't find anybody who even was close to my level of insanity. So when I asked the guy, I said, what do you do about getting a sponsor? I said, what is a sponsor anyway? I thought some guy gave you a jacket, Coca-Cola in the back or something like that, you know. I didn't know. It was the first time I was ever here. And he says, a sponsor is me. He was old. Yeah, old. And he was sober 16 years, you know. And I said, well, I need a sponsor. He said, well, you got one. He says, now we're going to do the steps. I said, aren't we rushing into this, Wally? He said, did you ever go into a bar room slowly? I thought I could get over on this guy, and in 3 minutes, I was totally convinced I had made a serious error. If I stay with you guys to the middle of summer, he will be my sponsor for 29 years. I have never out. It's amazing how my sponsor has grown in 29 years. Really. He's learned a lot, my sponsor has. Yeah. I think Mark Twain said something like that, too. But anyway, that's how it was. And we went through the steps immediately. You know, he wasn't interested in my feelings and all. He said, the ruling between you and me is going to be simple, Tom, something that you can understand. I'd rather step on your toes than stand on your grave. Even in my level of insanity, it was so clear I understood it. I understood what the priorities were. So I'm not worried about my feelings, you know. He says to me, when you pick up a drink, do you know when you're going to stop? I started to make up an excuse, you know, like we do, a non-committed excuse. He said, whoa. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions, and a yes or no will do. And I said the most spiritual words I've ever said in my life. I had 4 years of theology, you know, and I said the most spiritual words to Wally. I said, okay, Wally. That's what surrender is. It has nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. An agreement to follow the suggestion of another human being without guarantee on how it's going to turn out. That's what surrender really is. That's how it was with me and Wally. So he says to me, it looks like your parable's over alcohol. When you start? Okay, Wally. He says, did you come in and out or try to get sober on your own several times to get drunk? Yeah, Wally, I did that. He says, you're back here, aren't you? He says, so it looks like to me when you're stopped drinking and you're perfectly sober, you decide to pick up a drink. Sober. So he says, it looks like to me that when you stop, you don't know when you're going to start. And when you started, you don't know when you're going to stop. So you are in a perilous condition. Stopping and starting alternate. Perilous is staying. Say that again, Wally. He explained it to me. Okay? Now he says, you're a Hopkins man, a bright man like you ought to be able to figure out. What does a man who has lack of power do? And I try to BS him, you know how we do it. But he had mercy, he cut it short. And he said, you don't know. No, I said, I don't know. He says, how about getting some power? You think that might be an answer for a guy who has no power? Gunk. Yes, it will be. He says, you have now done steps 1 and 2. I said, I can't do 3 while I was going to do 3 the next day. And I told him I didn't believe in God. And he laughs. He broke out laughing. He says, you don't believe in God? He says, that's good. Say the damn prayer anyway. God don't give a damn what you believe. He says, you can jump off a 10-story building. You're going to go splat whether you believe in gravity or not. We don't care what you believe. Okay, Wally. Made a list. Yeah. Then went to make the... tell Wally about it. I held back the worst thing. Something I did as a kid, see, and I didn't want to tell Wally, my new friend, who I was trying to impress. I want to impress my sponsor. Someday I may do it. Not in the first 29 years, though. So I got down to the end of the last thing, and I had a sexual experiment with a little girl down the street when I was a young guy, and I was about her age, or maybe 2 years old. And I was afraid that he would say, get out of this place, I don't even want you in the state of Delaware. He didn't say that. He was drinking coffee, and he goes, how many times? That was my worst secret, man. I was carrying that around for 30 years. He wants to know how many times between sips of coffee. I really impressed him. Then I told him I was working on my character. I hear a lot of you industrious guys working. I'm working on my character defects. Yeah. Some of them even got them sweatbands. You know what I mean? You ever notice those guys in Maryland, the guys with sweatbands? Well, what's that all about? Most of them are unemployed. Well, they got a sweat, they don't work. What's a sweatband thing? You know? Maybe it's a union, I don't understand. You know? Probably. Well, anyway, they were working on it. So I told Wally I wanted to impress him how industriously I was pursuing this course. You know, I wanted to impress him again. Working on your character defects. He said, that's good. That's good, Tom. What step are you using? I said, 6. He says, that's great, Tom. You got the right step. He says, what does it say? I said, the instruction is, you know, we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Yeah, he said, that's right. He said, who? I said, God. He says, what do you got your fingers in there for? Do you know a sick mind cannot fix a sick mind? Whoa. I said, man, this guy plays hardball. And he don't go for no BS. He says, he asked God to remove him. See? Wow. Now he says, we're going to do the 7th step. Now, you're going to hear a lot of garbage in AA about people saying character defects and shortcomings are the same thing or the different thing. Bill was a good writer, and good writers seldom end following sentences with the same word. That's just a good writer. That's all. Clancy could tell you he's a good writer. Yeah, he was a professional writer. He knows. And I didn't. I heard it. I didn't know it until I told it to him. I don't know. And then we get to 7. Okay. We ask God to remove these things. How do you do that? I'll show you how he showed me. It takes 50 cents, though, the way he showed me. I thought this was free, but he said that was, this one step is 50 cents. I had to put a quarter in each hand. He says, here's half of your character defects. Here's the other half. Hey, you've been holding on to them all your life. Yeah. You liked some of them, didn't you? Yeah. Hold on. And you're standing there. And you're asking God to remove them. See? And when your heart is right, you simply open your hands like this. And you look at your hands. And you think about God. And He sees that you're open for those to be removed. And you will feel it. You will feel it. It doesn't mean it's removed forever. But it means you know the feeling of your defects being removed. So when it happens again, you will recognize it. Made a list of all these people. I had a real long list. He said, well, he said, you're not Charles Manson and you're not William Shakespeare. So I don't want you to write some stuff that is boring for me to read, you know, and is too long for you to write. So keep it sort of sweet, you know, short and sweet. He says, I'm old. And, I feel that way now. I like to talk in short sentences because I don't want to drop dead before I finish the sentence. And I knew what he meant, so I kept everything sort of short. Let me share, one. I wrote it all down, and I left out a couple of people. One was a girlfriend, of course. And one I want to make the first amend to was another girlfriend, but she was a little hotter than the second. Anyway, Wally had done all these steps before, so he knew. I tell you, I carried a guilt for 30 years. My father died when I was 19, and I'm the oldest of 9 kids. In my generation, you're the oldest boy, you went to work. That was not unusual, that was common. And I went to work and did well and all that stuff. And I even put a couple of my brothers and sisters through college. And all this stuff was expected. It's not unusual. I mean, today, these people, I don't know what they expect. But anyway. And my youngest brother left Maryland. He volunteered to go to Vietnam. And he said he never wanted to return to Maryland. That's what he said. And he didn't. He came back in a box. And I thought, because I was out making this money, and that was in first place in my life. I thought it was because of I was brilliant. I wasn't. I was excessive. That's what I was. But I knew about singleness of purpose before I got here. And I made a ton of money, and I could do things, eh? But I felt in my heart I neglected the personal attention a youngster needs. See? That's what I felt. I shortchanged it. And for that reason, he never wanted to return to Maryland. And that's what I carried in my heart. So he didn't want to be found. We even hired detectives. So anyway, a girl in Florida who knew my younger brother, got plenty of brothers, had 7 boys. And she said, your youngest brother, Pat, is dying from throat cancer in one of those beaches in Florida. So I told Wally about it. He said, you got that guilt. You better go down there and do this amends while he's still alive. Don't do him the casket. So I went down. I'm sitting on the airplane. You know, I'm Mr. AA. I'm going to do a perfect 9 step. You know that, don't you? Yes, so did I. And I go down and start talking to him. He says, I know what you're doing. I said, how do you know what I'm doing? He said, I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous 8 years. I said, oh, good. I took the paper and shoved it in my pocket. Put it away. I said, let's get down to cases. I can talk with you now. I felt very relieved. And I told him what I just told you. I thought I shortchanged him and you know, created some problems in his mind that he never wanted to come back to Maryland. He told me I was all wrong. I thought I introduced him to Brooks Robinson. He was a famous third baseman. I was friends with Brooks Robinson. John Unitas and Dorothy, I knew them personally. I knew them real well. When he was a little snot-nosed kid, I would take him and introduce him to these guys, and he was impressed. But I forgot all that. So don't trust your memory of what you remember and don't without talking to the sponsor. I forgot. So Shakespeare was right, that the good we do is interred with your soul. He was right. He reminded me of that stuff. And he says, I hope to have nothing but respect and love for you, Tom. I said, wow. He says, how about expensive Shirley? And I forgot all about expensive Shirley. Well, there was a girl I was dating. Her name was Shirley, and she was quite expensive. So, one Saturday night, she wanted to get married, and she was like a social worker, and I think I was like a project for her. You know what I mean? So, she wanted to get married, not particularly to me, but she wanted to get married. And I didn't want to get married. I was still having a lot of fun, you know, and I had a lot of money and had brand new cars. My mother dressed Pat up. He was about 3. In the cutest little sailor suit you ever saw. Oh, it just made me seasick. Just look at him. I put him up on the front seat of my brand new Roadmaster Buick. Big, long, black. He'd been past anything but a gas station. Anyway. I go out to see expensive. She takes one look at a car, looks in, she says, who's that? I said, that's my son. I never saw expensive anymore. So, he resolved, and he remembered that as some joy between he and I. I don't never really know how expensive took it, but you know, she did what she did. And then this is why we do the 9-step under direction. My perception was entirely wrong, and I was carrying guilt for 35 years for not extending to a young man under him. I was also his godfather. So, and I felt a lot of guilt because I had not fulfilled what I perceived as a responsibility. And I just felt very guilty for that. You know, we're people of principle, you know. And now because of AA, a good sponsor, and following directions, I no longer have that. See, that's how it happens. That's the reason we follow directions. Either that, like she said, or throw it away. So, and we go up to, when's 15 minutes up? Let me know. Yeah, just give me, okay, I don't know. I mean, I've been threatened by guys bigger than you. What the hell? You know? So, let me tell you about sponsorship and the greatest gift I get from sponsor. The first greatest gift I got from my sponsor was hope. I watch these yo-yos come in here and they give them here's a meeting book. You don't want to become a bus driver? What do you give them a meeting book for? Sponsor. Hope. That's the first thing. Then we'll give him knowledge. He can't handle the knowledge. Hope. He's hopeless. Everything he tried, like me, failed. This is hope. That's the first thing you get from a sponsor. Direction. Fear is removed when a sponsor not only tells you what he did, but he will also remove the fear by telling you how it turned out. It's like taking a test with the answers on the back of the book. It's a lot easier. That's what you get from a sponsor. That's what you get. When I sponsor people, it's the greatest gift I have. And your big book tells it. Nobody in AA believes it, and it's not really highlighted by some sponsors who prefer to be popular. Right. Oh, I'm going to lose my job, so I'm going to 19 meetings and 3 Hail Marys and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the Stations of the Cross. I asked one guy to make the Stations of the Cross. He said, if I could get the planes, he could steal the lumber. But he didn't know anything about that. Yeah. The book says practical experience has shown that nothing meaning no other thing, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive, not when you can fit it into your busy schedule, intensive work with others. And that is what a sponsor can really use as a tool to take your fearful hand into his and then slowly guide that fearful hand into the hand of a loving God of your own understanding. That's what a sponsor can do. And a good sponsor will bail out so that you can focus your attention on the real higher power. So that's how it is, what my sponsor has done for me. And he's done it with joy, with humor, with hope, and with love. Now it's my job to introduce the super messenger. I think he's got enough power to, well, don't even need a plane. But anyway, he doesn't need an introduction. I'm the one who needs the introduction. But anyway, from Los Angeles, California, my great friend, and sober a half a century plus, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And just so you won't be on edge any longer, although he didn't tell us, his name was Tom, and he's an alcoholic. The rude members of my group would let him get about three sentences in. They'd start, "What's your name, Tom?" You obviously are a better type of people here, so. But Tom squeezed a lot of stuff out of that 25 minutes. Yeah. But I'm very glad to be here tonight at this anniversary. I've been pleased to speak at the first meeting of this group, and every anniversary since, it's always a great pleasure to me. And I want to thank Jim for coming to the airport today. He brought Steve and John, and we gave them the bags, and then we talked about how much we've given to AA. But I've had kind of a memorable couple of weeks. A couple of weeks ago tonight, I was speaking in Bangkok, which is just about 5,000 miles beyond any lengths. And last Saturday night, I spoke in my hometown in Wisconsin, that I left 60 years ago, almost 60 years ago, the 50th anniversary of their club there, the club. And it really was kind of touching to me because it brought back a lot of memories that I think about. It changed one thing in my life. I've been talking for years how in 1950, somebody suggested I go to AA. That's the way I remember it. But I got there and somebody pointed out that isn't exactly what it was. I was in jail. And a kind of informal guy from AA walked over to the jail to get a drunk and take him over to the meeting. And I saw that. I said, "Oh, did you get out to go to an AA meeting?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I'm an alcoholic." So I went to my first meeting and had a terrible time. And you know, it's an interesting thing. How different people are on the outside. Tom and I have nothing in common. He's a Catholic. I'm a Lutheran. He didn't believe in God. I did. There's the difference. Well, I married a Catholic. My wife was a good Catholics who had child after child after child. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember saying to my wife, "Can't we use birth control?" "No." I've said this before, but I don't know what I'd have done if she'd have said yes. Because, at that time, 60 years ago, things were a lot different than they are now. I had been in the Navy overseas in World War II. I'd been through a major university, University of Wisconsin. And I heard the word condom once in my life in a Navy training film where they showed this voluptuous girl with the big hooters. A Presbyterian's mate, too, to hell with it. But anyway, and they said, if you are with this woman and don't use a condom, terrible things will happen. At that stage of my life, I wouldn't care what had happened to me. But what you'd have in those days is kind of hard to realize now, but kind of borderline bad kids would come around and say, I got a rubber. And even they'd be ashamed to go in and buy them. They'd get someone depraved. And even they would be ashamed. They'd go say things like, hey, give me a pack of cigarettes and some rubbers. Now look how much social progress we've made in all these years. The Rite Aid drugs over at my house, kids have been there. I guess they're grown up. They've been kids to me. They say things like, hey, give me a package of condoms and some cigarettes. Well, but I went on the campus of the University of Wisconsin last weekend, and I remembered something that changed my life. I'd grown up in that little town, Norwegian Lutheran town, and I had gone away to, I ran away when I was 15 years old, was in Pearl Harbor before my mother didn't know I was in Duluth, Minnesota. I took some tests at the end of the war, and I've been very good on tests because I read a lot. So I got a high school to graduation, although I'm still a beginning junior. I went to the University of Wisconsin, won some trophies for them, and got married in college, met this girl with black hair, something you never see in the Lutheran church. You see blondes and blondes and blondes. And she, I thought that was mysterious. It certainly was. But anyway, on graduation day from university, I gave a speech at commencement on behalf of the senior class. Then we went through commencement exercises, and we all got our diplomas, but mine was a blank diploma because I had gotten an incomplete in English history the last quarter, and so I had to go to summer school to make that up. And I'd been hired to teach journalism at Duluth, Minnesota, Denfeld High School, and so I had to go to summer school. Oh, I hated that. And I worked at a U.S. rubber company balancing white sidewall tires, $1,600 a shift, and I drank a lot. I started drinking when I was overseas, and I loved drinking, because drinking always made everything better. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you something sad. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go, but when a few drinks is just filling those holes, and you are, it's great. And that happens wherever you might be. And the only problem I ever had is I have a tendency to drink a little too much sometimes. Or as my psychiatrist pointed out later, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. But anyway, after work one night, I was sitting in a bar getting drunk again. I think how sad it was. This pretty girl was there. Turned out she was a traveling saleswoman, a magazine or something. Not telling her, you know, I did so much for that damn university, they're going to be screwing me around. And she said, I don't believe you won all the trophies. You don't seem to be a trophy winner. I said, I'll show you. We jumped in her car and went to the campus, and I kicked open the panel of a door, and we went inside to the big trophy case, and my pictures with the trophies, and it was all kind of dim because I was drinking. Apparently she slumped to the floor or something. And I thought she'd had a flat tire, and I was trying to pump her up. What a policeman's flashlight illuminated this scene. If you want to see a passion quatcher, boy, that's it. What are you doing there? Oh, nothing. They took us downtown and arrested us, because it was kind of serious that they took us downtown and arrested us. And oh, I felt so sorry. In the morning, we went to court. And before court started, somebody brought in a box of stuff and gave it to me. It was all the stuff I had at the university. And the note on top from the chancellor for the dean of men said, I told you I've tried to protect you. I told you hang in there just a little bit. You can't do it. I can't cover for you anymore. You're expelled. Then I get a telegram from Duluth saying your contract with us is abrogated on the grounds of moral turpitude. Kind of a big morning all in all. Then I went to court, and this judge was a friend of our family. By this time I was hungover and sick. And, oh, God, everything I've worked for all these years was gone. I said, Judge Farr, I'm so sorry. And he leaned forward and said, Clancy, I regret that you're so sorry. I thought, what the hell is that about? What do you mean, Judge? He says, in my experience, when people are that sorry, they're not only sorry for what they've done, but they're sorry because they know they'll do it again. I thought, that's stupid. I'll never do this again. Well, I didn't at that university, I'll tell you. So I had to change my entire career. And I got a job as a sports writer in a newspaper. And I had a flair for writing. I got into advertising and public relations. And I started having children. I had expenses. I got some big jobs. And many times I'd drink myself off them. I wouldn't call it drinking myself off them. I'd get in trouble. I'd start missing Mondays and part of the days, and they'd call me and say, Innocent, you're doing a nice job, but we've got to have you here. So I said, and I had a great idea based on that trip I'd made to Eau Claire County A Club. I said, they got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous, downtown Chicago, downtown Beloit, downtown wherever I was. And, you know, I got drinking overseas, and it's pretty tough over there. And these guys, oh, yeah, I understand. And I said, would you stick with me, maybe give me a couple weeks paid leave to get done, get cured at this Alcoholics Anonymous? And yeah, of course, because nobody knew much about AA. It was kind of a miracle thing. Go down there, and you could go home and say to your wife, well, dear, I've gone back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wonderful. Wonderful. What do they want you to do, honey? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for any slipper anywhere, ever, you know. No, they don't want you to take her off. You have to stop completely. We have the same steps you do, and we have a book. I release you, you son of a bitch. But through a series of ups and downs, I had big jobs and bad jobs, and had good jobs and lost jobs, and through a series of endless defeats and victories and bad breaks and misunderstandings, one morning I found myself in a situation where the best of my ability and talent cannot be in. Two big guys are throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles, and stay out of here, you bum! And I try to explain, well, I'm not a bum. Years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the old L.C. Nelmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. You know? I still said that old mission, that this can't be happening to me. But when it happened, I'd gone down in Dallas. I'd cost a big agency, a big account. My wife and children had finally left me. They repossessed my car. I had developed a very sarcastic and nasty way of being funny, and I alienated everybody. And I stood in Los Angeles. Somebody gave me a car to drive to Los Angeles, and I got as far as Phoenix, and I lost the car, and lost my clothes, and lost my ID, and got in jail that night. The guy kicked my front teeth out because I vomited out of the trunk. I got some looking so sad you're going outside to cry. And it doesn't get any better either. That's really one of the great downfalls of Alcoholics Anonymous speakers. No matter what they tell you, how sad it is, and then I got sentenced to 5 consecutive life terms, or whatever the hell it is, you know that sooner or later, in the next few minutes, he or she has got to say, but then, one day I walked through that door, and it's just one. It would be a lot more believable if every once in a while the Jesus speaker says, and then, God damn it, I just couldn't make it. Because that's the way it is when you're going through it, you don't know. Well, only 7 years to my sobriety date. But I was in and out of AA for years, and I knew all about it. I used AA town after town after town, and it got to be just kind of a laugh with me, these silly boobs and their little steps and their little, turn your life over to God. I could not do that. If you're new, it doesn't take long to understand what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's really quite simple. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. And it gets bad enough, they come to Alcoholics Anonymous and admit their problem is alcohol. Then they return to God. Then they show their gratitude by helping others. And they just live happily ever after. And I listened to that crap for 10 years. I mean, I don't know if I listened to it, I thought I listened to it. And I would not be here tonight if I hadn't discovered every one of those things are false. And if you believe them, you've got a good chance of dying drunk. Isn't that ironic? It seems so odd. I always knew my problem really wasn't alcohol. I'd sit in these Alcoholics Anonymous meetings after a while and wish I were an alcoholic. God, I wish I remember standing outside that mission in the rain, sick and cold, my teeth out, thinking, I wish I were an alcoholic. If some little guy would come to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120 some pounds. You've lost your wife and children, never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing your dishes. Look at you. Filthy, rotten, stinking. You've lost all your ID, all your money in that car in Phoenix. You can't even prove you are who you are. Nobody's going to hire you to do anything. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you, because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy and hope that'll help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And he might have said, you've been laughing at AA for 10 years now. You sit in these meetings and laugh and think these idiots, how lucky they are to have been born stupid. And now you're dying. And he might have said, why don't you go back to AA and admit you're an alcoholic once? Not have to tell them. I'm not. I wish I were. I wish I were. I wish my problems were alcohol. I've stopped drinking so many times hoping that would help. It doesn't help at all. Helps for a little while. Seems like when I stop, alcoholics stop, can't stop, or when they do stop, it's better. I can stop anytime. I've stopped many, many times. My problem has never been with that. My problem is after a day or two or three or four or five, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It comes out as just a little growing restlessness. Just a little irritability. Just a little tired of the daily sermon of what I did the last time I drank. Just a little tired watching whatever technicolor there is in my life go back to that stinking gray. And when I was making money, I spent a lot of it in psychoanalysis to try to beat that. I don't like to feel like that. I don't like pain. I don't like to be that way. And I spent a lot of money to find out why. I think about that later, Me finding out why is like standing on the deck of the Titanic. See, abandoned ship. I can't. I've got to find out why this happened. And you may find out why. You people in the boats, ha ha ha, I know why. I couldn't find out why. But I discovered one thing early on that didn't do me any good, but it sure helped me. But you know how you beat that feeling? Take a drink. God. And then sometimes you drink too much. They say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? Yeah, see, yeah, I guess it was. But inside you want to shriek, no, it wasn't alcohol. It wasn't alcohol. Alcohol is, makes it feel better. I just got to guard it so I don't keep drinking too much. I got to find a way to avoid that. I thought I was absolutely unique with these feelings. I'm sure many of us have had that feeling. I suppose if there's any one feeling all of us have had, I'm sure all of us have had the feeling, but my case is different. And we all have our own reasons for it. Too young, too old, too smart, too dumb, too rich, too poor, whatever it might be. But primarily, I have emotions you don't understand, and drinking makes me feel better. And now you want me to stop drinking, and I can't do it. And I didn't know what to make of all this. Didn't know what to do about it. And after I was sober, remember if I was sober a while, I read chapter three a couple times, didn't I? When you read the book, you skim it as fast as you can. But in chapter 3, I discovered on the first page and a half the story of my life. I must have read it. Never had any effect on it. In fact, I would say if there's any one page in AA that has a unifying effect of why we are here, it's that first page of chapter 3, although it doesn't read anything ridiculously wonderful, but it talks about what we have in common. And one of the things we have in common, not how much we drank or where we drank, but one of the things we have in common, somewhere along the line, we have voluntarily or involuntarily accepted the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And it goes on to say how we fight the term alcoholic. I suppose instinctively, because that means I can't drink, and then what will I do? And we have ups and downs, some bad little thing we have in common. Occasional brief recoveries, followed always by still worse relapse. If we didn't have the relapse, we wouldn't be here. And you keep fighting it until you get to what a delicious little phrase. State of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I remember reading that and thinking, Jesus, these people really get drunk. But that isn't what it means at all. That's how you feel after you get sober. After you get sober again. Pitiful and incomprehensible. And people want some explanation for your behavior. And I don't have one. So the answer is, leave me alone, damn it. Leave me alone. But I didn't know that. I kept fighting, trying to find a way to do it. And eventually it cost me everything. And the last day I stood outside of a Skid Row mission with my teeth kicked out, I would bet my life I was not an alcoholic. My problem really wasn't alcohol. It wasn't when I was drunk, but much worse the rest of the time. But I wanted to get out of the rain. And I said to some guy, Jesus, where's an ache? I'd learned. Here's something if you want to be a long-term slipper, you want to put this in your mind. When you really get having a bad day and you smell bad and look bad and you can't find any place to go, there's one place that always welcomes you, an AA club. The worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Fred. And I said, where's the AA club around here? He says, well, it's done down here. It's out on the west side. How do I get there? I'm so sick. And so. He said, well, you have to go up hill to Hill Street and cut over to Wilshire and walk west till you come to Fairfax. The way I went, and I was walking, still vaguely remember walking that rain, walking and walking and walking. I count some years later in the car, 7.5 miles. That's a long way to walk when your mouth is bleeding and you're sick and you're hungry and desperate and need a drink and everything's terrible. I got to this stupid old AA club. And right inside the door, one more of those fools. Welcome home, son. Ha 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 ha.
But I learned from the club that the other night they had a meeting. I was just sitting out of the rain, waiting for it to stop raining. They served cake, and they had about 4 pounds of cake, because I could chew that. Then I went to a meeting, and they had on gratitude, and I almost puked it all up again. Then everybody went home, but it's still raining. And I had one tool left in my quiver. I thought it was a great tool. I realized now it was a goof thing, but at the time I thought it was so cute. I thought I had a sincere newcomer look that would just fool people. And the manager of the club was saying, well, we've got to close up now. I'm a newcomer. And I have no place to stay. It's raining outside. It's very cold. Could anybody help me? He says, you're in luck, kid. Got him. Guy left for 49 Merck in the parking lot last summer, I should say. He didn't run, but you can sleep in it, it's dry. Have you mean to tell me the Alcoholics Anonymous answer in Los Angeles is to sleep in an abandoned car? Yeah, good deal, huh? Well, I slept in that car the night when the next morning turned out to be Sunday morning. I had an early morning meeting. I had served cake, and then they had a meeting about God. And I got up and left that because I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage. I believe in God, and I know with my life I'm going to go to hell, and I don't want to hear about it. In fact, my son died when I was in jail once, and I realized why he died. He died suddenly because this Norwegian Lutheran God took my little boy who never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me because I was bad. Screw you! You get me in hell, but you never get me between now and then. Damn little son of a bitch! You know, just crazy. I never want to be anywhere where they talk about God again. And I know that A, you're going to return to God. Well, I'm not going to return to God. And my problem is the alcohol. I wish it were. And I don't know what to do. But I went to sleep in an abandoned car. And the next morning I came in and hung around the club that night, did another meeting. Another manager said, you know, we have to be, on the weekends you can come in here, but during the week you have to have a membership. He said, you can't just come in here and sit around and like you've been doing, making your smart remarks. He said, but if you die in our parking lot, it's going to make me look bad. So you can come in, but three laws. No asking for money. No none of your smart remarks, our sarcastic little remarks about AA. You have to go to a meeting every night. Jesus. I just would almost rather die than go through that crap. If I had a coin, I'd have flipped it, I'll tell you. I had 2 quarters, actually, but when I hold my hand, they fell out. Tough around here, don't ever talk. But I went that, and I went to these meetings, I sat around the club, it just kept raining day after day. I thought I was in hell, actually. And that was my sobriety day. Who would guess it? Why in the world would I stay sober? I didn't want to stay sober. When my little son died, I wanted to stay sober. And I took a vow in his casket I wouldn't drink again. And I kept that vow so long I committed suicide. They put me in the state insane asylum. That's what sobriety does for me. And I got out of there the next year. I had a terrible time there, and I didn't want any more to do with God. And why would I stay sober this time? I believe in God, and I believe there's no sense in trying to live. I'm going to go to hell anyway. I know all about AA, I know more about AA than the people talking to me about it, because I've been around listening to these people yap for 10 years. And why in the world would I stay sober? I'll tell you, it gets down to this. I was enjoying listening to Tom talk. He met Wally. But he met Wally and he made a connection. I had a lot of sponsors. I never made any connection with any of them. Most of them were dumb. What I found in that week I was going to AA meetings while it kept raining, I saw a guy in 2 or 3 meetings who I'd seen in the movies. A movie actor. What does a movie actor tell you? rich. I bet he would like a new friend. And I tried to ease up to him, but he didn't want a new friend, and so I had to go to the whip on Friday. I said, Bob, I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? Yeah, kid, I want you to do what I tell you, though. Oh, sure, Bob. I thought, I'm just idiot. And turned out he wasn't a movie star at all. I found out later he'd been in 3 movies as a character actor. And that's all he ever was. I've been in more movies than he's ever been in. But I didn't know. And they said he wasn't a good actor, but he was. He acted nicely in meetings, and that took a lot of acting for him, I'll tell you. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig, just the worst sort. Do this, do that. Now, but why am I taking this crap from this guy? Because he is my only means to get out of there that I can see. But he was a good guy. He tried to help me. He'd talk. It took me a couple times with him to hear him talk, and he'd talk to me in the club sometimes. And he saw that I got fed sometimes. But I had a problem with him. It was obvious I was much more intelligent than he was. And I had to disguise that, because no one wants to sponsor people more intelligent than you are. So I had to pretend to be dumb. God, that's hard. He'd say dumb things, and say, gee, that's really good, Bob. I really... One night we were in a meeting, and I already told him, I said, Bob, I want you to know one thing. I want to be honest with you. I didn't want to be honest with him. I just tried to throw him off. I said, I'll tell you, I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were, but I'm not. My problem is not really alcohol. I've got a lot of problems. I've been spent thousands and thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and I just want you to know that. He said, okay, I understand that. I know people like you. But one night we were in a meeting somewhere where he had talked. And after the meeting, I heard him talking to somebody, and he said something even more stupid than I was used to hearing. He said, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. And on the way home, I said, Bob, why did you say that to that guy in an AA meeting telling him his problem wasn't alcohol? Because his problem wasn't alcohol. Jesus, Bob, were the lights pretty hot on the setup every day? I could make him crazy in about 2 minutes when I wanted to. But anyway, he gave me a long harangue, most of which I was able to blot out, thank God, before he made me insane. Some of it apparently got through when I didn't really understand it. And I look back now, and it was the beginning of the changing of my life. He said, kid, we don't want people whose problem is AA, alcohol, to be in AA. Who do you want, Bob? He says, people have an alcohol problem and got no business being in AA. They take up our time, they take up our space, and it's unnecessary. He says, if people with alcohol problems don't need AA. Oh, is that so, Bob? What do they do? You stop drinking, you clean up your act, and you don't drink again. I said, that's stupid. I've tried that 200 times. That doesn't work. He said, no, it doesn't work probably because you have the same problem we got. It's not an alcohol problem. Oh, what could it be, Bob? Is it something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking here, and it fools people till they die from it. It's something called alcoholism. And oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm pretty smart. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And he said, look, kid, this alcoholism, let me tell you about that. Unfortunately for you and me and people like us, it looks almost exactly the same as an alcohol problem. But this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism. The difference is this. You clean up your act and you stop drinking, and the only long-term effect is it eventually makes it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They always say, no, you stop drinking, it gets better. Well, maybe for a couple of days, he said. Not very long. I didn't know that. I said, if that's the case, Then why do these damn alcoholics drink when they know it's going to eat them up? He says, they don't drink because they know it's going to eat them up, kid. You don't seem to know very much for you, say, but someone know much about AA. He says, you know what an alcoholic is? He says, the person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. I said, yes, I know that. It's just the phenomenon of craving. Then they go mad and run less and go crazy. Said, ah, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink. And he had a Coke in his hand. He said, kid, if this were Johnny Walker, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained and them less threatening and frightening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you moron. I said, you mean to tell me that everybody who drinks don't get those feelings? He said, no. A small percentage of people who drink get those feelings. For most people, alcohol goes, blah, blah, blah. But for you and me, apparently, it goes, blah, blah, blah. I didn't know that. He said, you say you've been in, you spent all your thousands of dollars in therapy, I heard you tell somebody. Do you know any therapy in the world, anywhere, that works as well as alcohol for you and me? Guy going his way to commit suicide. Stopping in the bar, getting a couple of going away drinks. I give it my best shot. Ten minutes later, you're down the bar saying, you with anyone, Granny? He said, now that's a therapy. That's his mom. But I don't understand that. If it does that for you, then it gets bad and you quit. But if that meeting tonight, there's some guy who had quit and been sober a while and got drunk again. Why would he do that then if it's going to be so bad for him? He said, that's the other part of the problem, kid. And he had a theory that he told me about that I thought sounded kind of stupid. But I was listening to an old tape of mine somebody gave me from years and years ago, a few years ago, and I listened to it and I thought, my God, that's exactly true. He said, kid, when people are born and grow up, it's really tough growing up mentally and emotionally. He says, there's so much crap you have to go through, and you have to take crap from people in lifetime. It seems unfair. You have problems you got to find solutions to, and obsessions and conflicts you got to resolve, and you got to take crap, and you have love affairs, and they break your heart, and the ones you love run away, and you can't remember their name, and just all in all. So that whole process is called maturing. But if you become a mature individual, you live pretty comfortably. You can hold a job as long as you want to. Get along with your co-employees instinctively. Get along with your mate if you have one. Have some idea how to be a parent to your kids. Get along with the neighbors, understand what the hell their problems are. Go on square vacations and enjoy them just the way they are. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not? Uh-huh. He said, because we've been kind of fortunate. Along the way, we've discovered when we have problems we can't find an answer to, or a conflict we can't resolve, we can drink them away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And I can tell you from experience, it really works. But what he explained to me is that every time that works, another little stealie gets in this secret little bag in your stomach somewhere. And you get a lot of them. You don't even hardly notice them until the day comes. But most of us have done this, I'm sure. I'm going to quit drinking. Enough of this. I'm just sick of taking this crap all the time and being abused and getting all this hurt. I'll just quit drinking. I'm going to go to work and come home and eat dinner at home and not stop with those boobs and drink and have a good time and get along fine. And never once know that it's impossible for people like me to do that. Because something will happen, either in my domestic life, in my work, or somewhere else. Just say, let's take work, for example. That's what used to get me. I'm going to quit drinking and everything's fine. But something happens. Someone hurts my feelings. Someone puts me down. Someone denigrates me a little bit. That starts the old steelies going. When I was young and fancy free, I had an easy answer for that. I punched the sandwich in the mouth and quit the job. But when you got a wife and kids, you got to pay for a house, you can't do that anymore. So you got to take it. And realize, this guy, what's he trying to do? Screw me around? He's probably talking bad about me behind my back a lot. Trying to say. And after a while, it gets after a few days, you begin to see that his friends are in on it too. Putting you down a little bit. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't get revenge without being found out. Sometimes you lie awake at night thinking about this. Why are these people screwing me around? Why are they doing this to me? It gets pretty bad. You get to a point, that's the one with the top on. That's lucky. But you get to a point, scientists say people like us get to a point where sometimes we have to drink to preserve our sanity. Isn't that ironic? And eventually I drink. And that starts the pilot light, and pretty soon, boom, and I'm out of a job again pretty soon. They say, oh, geez, Clancy, you got such a great job. What happened there? Oh, they're a bunch of phonies I never liked. There's a crazy company. I'll get a better job. And I would. He said, that's the problem. People like us, sooner or later, the conflicts of our sobriety will make it imperative we drink. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. Why doesn't AA explain it the way you do, instead of this old crap about allergy of the body and obsession of the mind? He says, they do, kid. Look at the wall up there, where it says one. You are asked to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Then it says you have to admit you're having a problem without alcohol. I said, huh. So that's all the first step is, just admitting it. My God, Bob, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I've really been something sometimes, and now I'm living in the backseat of an abandoned car being ridiculed by people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, what could that be? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, my God, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I guess I am. I thought someone whose problem was alcohol. Nah. Someone whose answer is alcohol. And alcohol goes bad on them, and now they're screwed. That was in December of 1958, long time ago. I was 6 weeks sober. My life didn't get suddenly better. But it did one thing for me I could see in retrospect. It took away the fear that I secretly was insane. Maybe there's a name for this, if it's just like that. And eventually, over a period of time, I stayed sober. My sponsor made me get little jobs. And I think the great turning spot, when I was about 3 months sober, I got fired in a job, I got fired at all the time. And I saw him in the club. I felt so bad that day. I said, Bob, I got to talk to you. I've never said this to a soul before. I've never been sober 3 months. But I just want you to know, I'm corrupt. I'm corrupt mentally. I'm corrupt psychologically. I use people terribly. I've hurt so many people. I step on people. I have no friends left after all these years. I ruined my family. I ruined everything. When I was a boy, I wanted to grow up to be like a Viking and do good in the world. I'm just a rotten son of a bitch, Bob. And I know he's going to say, "Why don't you get out of here?" He's old. I know a lot of people like you, kid. Don't worry. He said, "I know how you feel." And I thought about that later. Does he know how I feel? That doesn't seem possible. All my life, people have been saying, "I know how you feel," but I know they don't. My dad, my doctor, my psychiatrist, my minister. They all say, "You have to say, gee, thanks," but you want to say, "No, you don't." And I came to start to believe this guy knew how I felt, which was the most significant thing that I think in my early sobriety. Because I'll tell you, if you're new, until you find someone that you have some inkling may know how you feel, it's just information around here. But with that, it becomes something more. It becomes identification. Now you say, what makes AA work? Let me tell you something, just a side for help. People sometimes are disappointed because there's nothing new in AA. I found that in another book, and I found this in another book. There's nothing new in AA at all. Bill Wilson compiled a bunch of ideas. What's the big deal about that? What makes AA work is that identification enables people to believe it and take the actions. Information never kept anybody sober, like us. But identification. That's why they talk so much about singleness of purpose. Now, I've been working with addicts for over 40 years. I bet I know more about addiction than most any addict I ever met. But when I sit in a meeting like this, somebody gets up there glibly talking about shooting up and snuffing up. That's just information. But I want to hear some goof get up there.
"Well, I've been drunk a lot and I'm having a terrible time, but Jim has said he'd help me and I believe him, and I've been sober over a month. Thanks a lot."
I know how that goes. And there are variations thereof. You say, what's so important about it? Let me give you an example. A couple of months after that, I was at the Brentwood meeting with my sponsor. Brentwood meeting was just 6 blocks from where O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife later. We were standing there, and he said, "See that woman over there?" I said, "Yes, I see her, that stinking Happy Austin. She's bagged." He said, "I want you to apologize to her." I said, "Why should I?" So someone told me at the Monday night meeting you called her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. I can't think of a person in the world who told me that I would not have said, "To hell with you! Go there and abase myself in front of that old puss bag. All she's ever been is badmouth me and undermine me and say bad things about me." So I go over there to apologize to her. She'd go, "I made that Clancy crawl. I'd rather die than do that." But somebody that I have come to believe knew how I felt told me to do it. And for the first time in my memory, I found myself taking an action that I was absolutely against. "I'm sorry I called you a bitch." "You bitch." "You got me not to quit a job that I wanted to quit because they were hurting my feelings. You got me to go to meetings where they denigrated me, it seemed to me. And little by little, my life got better. I held jobs once for 4 months, 5 months. But another thing, I want to go through this quickly when we get out of here. But eventually what happens in AA is they want you to do the steps. I guess some of the steps are fine, but as far as I'm concerned, the first 3 steps have killed more alcoholics than anything I know. Not that there's anything wrong with the steps, but the reading of them. I told you about it earlier. People die thinking their problem is not alcohol. And it isn't really, it's alcoholism, partially alcohol. But my sponsor said, "Let's work the steps." And I told him, I can't return to God, Bob.
I know all about God and I can't return to it. He says, nothing at AA says you got to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Does that fool the other boys and girls? Does it fool me? But it doesn't say that either. Read what it says on the wall there, for God's sakes. Two, came to believe. We never ask you to return to anything, any sickness, any weird superstition. You come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in a loving God?
I said, no, I can't.
He says, can't you believe in AA?
I said, well, I like it a little better than I used to, but not much.
He says, you think I'm doing better than you are?
Of course you are, Bob.
Congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that, because he couldn't send me to hell. He tried, he couldn't. But I believed, and what I want to tell you about the second step is this. People read all sorts of things into it, they interpret it. It's so hard to understand that these steps mean what they say. That's what they mean. You have to try to come to believe there's some power here. You don't have to know what the power is, and certainly how it's going to do it. But there's somehow it's going to restore your sanity. And, you know, you don't have to know. I mean, but it must be working because there's a room full of people. Didn't all come here to shuck you. Now, but the crux in that step, restore you to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 medical textbooks and get 10 different definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. It goes something like this. When the human brain is under sufficient conflict and the pain intensifies, you can find no resolution. Sometimes, in a desperate attempt to maintain its neural integrity, it will alter its perception of reality. That is called psychosis, when you see things differently than other people see them. Sometimes it's the whole world you see differently, and you're easy to spot, and they put you away. But usually it's just a little thing that has to be triggered. You see things in the paper. I lived in a store with this guy for 10 years. Nice guy. Came home one night, took a rifle, killed all his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Why would he do that? I don't know, but something triggered his psychosis. All right, here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The incidence of alcoholic psychosis is almost invisible. You'd think we'd be the number ones. And if you're new, you might say, well, they say alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. And it is, but not from that, from a different form of insanity. Everybody in this room has ever been drunk a lot, knows what it feels like to wake up in the morning and need something to put the fire out.
Jesus.
Now, why would a fluid make you so thirsty? I'll tell you why. Alcohol is the only fluid I've ever heard of that dries out your body as it goes through your veins and arteries. It kills all the cells it touches. It kills millions and millions of cells every time you're drunk. Then when you induce fluids, the cells come alive. Then the next time you get drunk, they die. Then you induce fluids, they come alive. This happens again and again and again. It's just so amazing. And there's nothing wrong with this except for one little thing. There are two organs in the body that when their cells die, they don't revive again. They stay dead. One is your liver, which is one of the reasons we have bad livers, and one is your brain, which is one of the reasons we have bad brains. And it takes a lot of drinking, pounding away, but you can dry out your brain till you get to a point called the Korsakoff syndrome, which means a dry brain. Ironically, in AA, we call it a wet brain, but it's a dry brain. And you may think you have it, or you know someone who has it. I almost certainly can tell you that's not true. You will probably never see a case of it. I see them all the time, and I wish I didn't. But a person with the Korsakoff syndrome is not running the streets acting crazy. He's sitting in a ward somewhere, or she, and they come and change his diapers, and feed him, and put him to bed, and get him up, and feed him, and change his diapers, and put him to bed, and on. Just like the last stages of Alzheimer's, except Alzheimer's has the decency to kill the patient. With alcoholic insanity, you can sit like that for 50 years if your body's strong enough. Family comes down and says, let's go down and see if mom recognizes us.
Oh, Mom, you remember? Get away from me. You stink. I hate you. I never saw you. You cry and go home. Alcoholic insanity is a terrible, terrible thing. But why don't alcoholics become psychotic? And the answer is so simple to that that the guy that told me that, I almost fainted because it's so true. When it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol. What does alcohol do? It alters my perception of reality. I have the ability, and so do you, to induce temporary psychosis. That's more like it. And then tomorrow we'll be back to reality until you can't stand it again, and then you drink some more. So I guess what the second step means, if it means what it says, and I presume it does, you have to come to believe there's some power here. Whether you've identified it yet, and certainly don't know how it's going to do it, will make it unnecessary for you to drink alcohol. Came to believe that the power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity. And the last step in this dreadful trilogy that held me, because he gets so religious, came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. Or came to believe that a power greater than myself, that turned my will and my life over to the care of God. And I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. And I realized that by this time I started to feel a little part of AA, and I thought I got to do something here. So I rewrote it in my mind. My third step read, I will try to do what Bob says. That sounds kind of silly, but saved my life. And then later on, as my betters explained it to me, that's what the third step said. Maybe you shouldn't have turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And that's how I understood him then. As a result of that, little by little, I took actions. And was a few months ago, I was going to commit suicide one day, and he had me write an inventory. I swore I'd never write. I read it to him. He had me, like Tom was talking about, made amends, made lists of people, and little by little, my life changed. When I was got a year sober, I'd held a job 4 months that year without getting fired, which was a record up to that time for a long time. I want to just get one thing straight. This is the sign for spontaneous applause, and this is for silly laughter. Oh, I didn't realize you were the founder of the group. I'm sorry, Jim. A short time in a row there. Anyway. When I was my second year, I held a job almost 7 months before I got fired. At the end of my second birthday, I finally got a job offered to me. I had a little one-room apartment in Hollywood next to the Villa Capri with a little kitchenette with a hot plate and a refrigerator and a shower. And in the next room, there's an old sofa that pulled out into a bed. And I'll tell you, I was more thrilled with that than any house I've ever had. I'd go to the library, get piles of books, and just spend all the weekend reading, except it was time to go to a meeting. Had a wonderful time. But I was offered this job as a writer in a medical corporation, beginning writer. My sponsor took me down to St. John's Thrift Shop in Santa Monica and got me some rather ill-fitting clothes and shirts and suits and some shoes. And I still had no front teeth, but I was learning to carry my lip like this, so nobody knew it. And I went to work there, and the first assignment I got, it was just something, I happened to know something about it, and I could write well, and I just ate them up. One of the better things ever, I just turned it, they said, I can't believe that you wrote this, and we just gave you this assignment earlier this week, how did you do it? Oh, I don't know. I'm on my way now, baby. Here, launch pad. And about a week later, I was gloating. I heard a guy say, that guy doesn't even have any front teeth. Well, I'll be damned. Trying so hard to do something. Now it starts again. And he's going to start this up, and he's going to keep going. I might as well just pop him and quit the job, because I'm never going to be anything, I guess. But then I thought, if I do that, I'll have to explain to that damn Bob. I called Bob. I said, this guy put me down. Bob, I really cracked him. He said, why do you say that? I said, what the hell are you talking about? Why do you say it? Because he's trying to put me down. He said, find out why he said it. Ask him. I said, that's ridiculous. He said, find out. I got this guy aside that said, I guess you think it's pretty funny I don't have any front teeth, huh? He said, oh, no, just the opposite. I was telling someone, you know, you turn that great piece in, and you're wearing ill-fitting clothes, obviously secondhand, and you got no front teeth, so something bad must have happened to you back there somewhere. And you're making a comeback. And writing that way you are, I'll tell you, my hat's off to you. And I said, oh. And I had several little things like that every time I was 5 years old. I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. Had front teeth, smiled a lot. Many of you new folks missing teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become wonderful, they grow back. Yeah. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood. We created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. We brought the Beatles in from England. We were just slicker than you could imagine. I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Very active in AA all this time. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas. Leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God some Catholic friends of me gave me a book on the rhythm system, and we all ended that good. Sorry, dear, not tonight. I got a sick headache. Now they've all grown up. Three of my daughters turned 19 last year. Hey, it looks like they're going to turn 20 this year, I guess. And my other children aren't alcoholics. The last child who was born was a son to finally replace the son I'd lost. I cried at the hospital. And he grew up, and I nurtured him, I'll tell you. He got to be captain of the high school football team. I've flown back from all over the world to run the 10-yard chains on his team. And he went off to the University of New Mexico School of Computer Knowledge and became a wizard and came home, and he sits in an office in Santa Monica and he supervises the creation of big games. He just finished Spider-Man 3 and stuff like that. And he's turned into an alcoholic. And I'll tell you something ironic about AA. I sponsor people, a lot of people. Jim came up for my birthday and met a lot of people from all over the world that I sponsor. And I can't help my own son, because that's the nature of alcoholism. And it happens. I know that they've watched people try that for years and years. I know. See, I guess the reason is when you talk to the kid, that isn't AA talking to him. That's the old man with some more of his crap. You know? You can't help your sister as a rule. You can't help your parents. You can't help anybody. You have to help somebody that you don't even know or care about even. So I pray for him every night. But he's lost his wife now, and his job is on the cusp. And I don't know what's going to happen to him. And it was ironic. He grew up in a house that was full of AA members his whole life. And his three sisters have all interceded on his life. He says, I understand. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. And God sends a shiver down my spine. But I'll pray for him again tonight. But only one of my daughters has turned out badly. One of my AA daughters, my oldest one. She's become a judge. We so wanted a defense attorney just to be in case, you know. She comes home for Christmas a few years ago. She says, Daddy, remember years ago when you'd get so upset when we were trying to stop drinking and you'd scream at us and send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I have no need to go to Albuquerque. But what I want to say quickly, I want to get done with this now, because I know some of you have many blocks to go to your home. One of the things I learned about over the years,
You know, if you're new, when I knew, I remember thinking, people say they're 2 years sober, I thought, geez, you're getting pretty dry. Now, I've been sober 50 years, and if I'm so dry, I might burst into flame up here. But that's what AA isn't about at all. You'll be as dry as 30 days sober as you'll ever be in your life. The purpose of AA took me a long time to understand. It's been a lot of education and coming to believe in God, that I, a God that I pray to, not, who no longer Bob. Coming to understand the purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality and make it a friendly place. To change my relation to people around me, to give me some life, to get some self-confidence, so I'm not offended by every passing glance or word. And the funny thing about it is, it doesn't come all at once. It comes in little increments. You can come in your first 30 days for a brief moment. What was that feeling? You know, I felt good. If you keep doing these things and taking these steps and trying to help people, eventually it comes quite a bit. When I was 15 years sober, I was doing quite well. My kids were all doing well. I had some money in the bank. I've been going my way. Marlene, who's sitting down here, had been sober. I'd been sponsoring her for 8 years. By that time, I realized it was a hopeless case. And I got feeling good, kind of too long. I felt good. And I found myself doing something that nobody sane would do. I left my job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 35 years, I run the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why don't you give up your great advertising career to run that damn mission? And there's no good answer to that one. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. It's kind of different now. When I get home now, I'll get up in the morning. I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles, big house, big yard. Today, or yesterday, there's 150 A's in my backyard playing softball and volleyball. Been doing it for 40 years. And I'll get on the Santa Monica Freeway, go through Beverly Hills, try to not drive, turn off, and go to this ravaged, sick, dreadful area in downtown Los Angeles called Skid Row. And I'll park under the building and take my morning walk around the building and see the people I know who are dying around me and talk to them. Sometimes step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity and abandonment. And then I'll go in and our staff and I will spend all day trying to get some way to find some way to get these poor bastards to acknowledge they got a problem, be willing to do something. It's got nothing to do with AA, it's way below that. We're just stay alive for God's sakes. And sometimes we get them and some of them get to AA, but and some of them do well, but very rarely. Skid Row people are almost impossible because they've given up trying. And then I'll go home, eat dinner, go to a meeting. Doesn't sound like much of a life, but it's a good life for me. The interesting thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you keep doing it, I'll tell you what's the most amazing about it. As I told you, I think 2 weeks ago, I was speaking at a convention in Bangkok. And last week in my hometown in Wisconsin. And next weekend in Grand Cayman Island. In the last couple of years, I've been in South Africa and Scandinavia and France and all over the world. And you'd think you'd really find exotic AA in these places. But except for the accents, you hear the same. You might as well sit in your home group. Some people can't believe they're really alcoholic. Some people try to console them. Some people back from their slip, on and on, you know. In Thailand, 2 weeks ago, they had some Thai people talking, and they had a guy translating for us over there from English. Guy was just tedious, just the same old stuff I've been hearing in my home group for 50 years. It's what's remarkable. We are so similar at that level. Our surfaces look so different, and we can leave here and get drunk and believe they are not like them, they don't understand, my case is different.
But if you can stay here long enough and get down to the 17th, my God, I'm just like him. I'm just like him. Thank God I've stayed here long enough to find out. Because it turns out Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you what it is. You know, I've said this a lot, but I believe it so intensely. What it really is, I mean, I don't understand how you can spend a whole weekend studying the steps, because they're simple. I don't understand how you can spend weeks reading the one chapter in the book. See what it really means. It means what it says again and again. But what Alcoholics Anonymous is, when you put it all apart, when you, all the books, all the meetings, all everything, it can be whittled down to one sentence. Because this is what AA is. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, the miracle starts. Thank you.
Right.